presentation, has health behavior changed? Does the physical therapy literature reflect the pandemic of lifestyle-related conditions? And our presenters are Jamie, Tracy, Sarah, and Rick.
Thank you guys for coming in and we'll let this phone call. So welcome to our presentation. To just provide a quick overview, I'll be starting with the introduction and the rationale for our research topic. And from there, we'll be discussing the methods we use, the results, and then finishing up with the discussion and a conclusion. So it's becoming common knowledge in the healthcare field that lifestyle-related conditions, for example, ischemic heart disease, chronic bronchitis and emphysema, hypertension, stroke, diabetes mellitus, and some cancers are leading causes of death worldwide. Key lifestyle behaviors, such as inactivity, tobacco use, poor nutrition, obesity, elevated stress, and suboptimal sleep contribute to the conditions I just mentioned. These lifestyle-related conditions decrease quality of life of individuals, and they strain healthcare system resources. As we know, physical therapy is a healthcare discipline that is well poised to tackle these lifestyle conditions through non-invasive practices, such as healthy lifestyle education. So this research examined if the physical therapy literature has adequately responded to the increasing prevalence of comorbidities and lifestyle-related conditions that we see in the present day. The specific purpose of our study was to determine if the pandemic of lifestyle-related conditions has led to a change in the volume of literature on physical therapy involvement in lifestyle behaviors over the last 20 years, specifically the lifestyle behaviors of physical activity and exercise, smoking cessation, nutrition optimization, weight control, stress management, and sleep hygiene. We had two aims, the first of which was to determine if the proportion of peer-reviewed articles published on each of the six lifestyle behaviors in physical therapy journals has changed from 1986 to 1989, and then from 2006 to 2009. The second was to look at the overall proportion of peer-reviewed articles on the lifestyle behaviors published in the same physical therapy journals over the same two time periods. To begin our research, we developed a list of operational definitions. They are seen here. This was used to define some of the important keywords and lifestyle behaviors we'll be discussing. And this list is available upon request from our group should anyone require more clarification during the question and answer period. I'll now hand it over to Rachel, who will take you through the methods.
Thanks, Sarah. So we wanted to look at trends in the generalist physiotherapy literature. So to do this, we chose to look at the five major generalist physiotherapy journals. We chose these five journals here, the Australian Journal of Physiotherapy, Physical Therapy, Physiotherapy, Physiotherapy Canada, and Physiotherapy Theory and Practice, because a study released in 2001 identified these five journals as the core evidence-based physical therapy-specific journals. They based this information on impact factors, number of RCTs, and the quality of the studies included in the journals. So we chose to search for articles in these journals using the database CINAHL, because it contained all five of our journals. Originally, we did think that it had all five of the journals for both time periods, but when we looked further into it, we discovered that full-text articles were not available for four of those journals in the original time period. So for the Australian Journal of Physiotherapy and for Physiotherapy Theory and Practice, we ended up doing title page searches from the title pages that were available on the journal's websites. And then for Physiotherapy and Physiotherapy Canada, we did hand searches of the print journals available in Woodward Library. Other than that, we did set up search strategies for all five of the journals. We ended up having to make two different search strategies, one for each time period. So we chose mesh headings and keywords that related to each of our six lifestyle behaviors, as well as mesh headings and keywords for a seventh category that was based more on general health promotion articles in order to pick up any articles that weren't categorized under our six lifestyle behaviors but still promoted changes in lifestyle behaviors and improvements in health. So we did have to choose different mesh headings for the two different time periods because the mesh headings have changed over time. So for example, in the earlier time period when we wanted to retrieve articles on smoking cessation, we searched for articles in our five journals. We then searched for articles with the mesh headings like smoking cessation programs or smoking prevention and control. We combined the mesh headings with keywords that we thought would pick up a greater number of articles. And then we combined the mesh headings and the keywords with the journals using AND. And then we even went more specific and just individualized it to each journal. We limited it to the time period, and we limited the journal or the articles to English. We originally did limit it to humans as well, but as the other group mentioned yesterday, that actually eliminated about a quarter to half of the search results because not all of the articles are limited properly. So we had to revise that later. Once we had retrieved all of our articles in our search strategies and all of our title pages, two independent reviewers went through the titles and abstracts, and we kept articles that met our inclusion criteria. If the independent reviewers could not reach agreement, a third reviewer went through the articles to make the final decision on whether or not it would be included in our study. So the inclusion criteria our articles had to meet were that they had to be peer-reviewed, written in English, published in one of our five journals, and in one of the two time periods. They had to be focused on one of our six lifestyle behaviors, and they had to promote health according to the World Health Organization definition. So a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. We excluded articles which discuss long-term lifestyle modifications for any one condition, for example, a knee injury or low back pain, but we kept articles that talked about lifestyle-related conditions, such as cardiovascular disease, smoking-related respiratory conditions, hypertension, stroke and cerebrovascular disease, cancers, diabetes mellitus, and obesity. We also excluded articles that talked about only short-term treatments as opposed to ongoing interventions over a lifetime to address health behavior changes. Then, because we were interested in looking at the proportion of articles so that we could account for differences in the total number of articles published in these five journals between the two time periods, we set up a new set of inclusion and exclusion criteria in order to come up with the total counts of articles published in these five journals. And again, two independent reviewers went through all the title pages to add up the total number of articles published. We again included articles that were peer-reviewed, written in English, published in the five journals, and in one of the two time periods. And then because the journals had very specific types of articles and they had quite a wide variety between all five, we included articles like case reports, clinical reports, et cetera, ones that were evidence-based and peer-reviewed. And we excluded articles like editorials, commentaries, equipment notes, things that were not evidence-based or peer-reviewed. So now, Jamie's gonna go through the results and tell you about what we found after we performed our research.
Okay, we have two flowcharts further outlining our method. The first one here for the 1986-89 time period, and the next slide for the 2006-2009 time period. The top row shows the number of returns in CINAHL for each of the six specific lifestyle behaviors, as well as a seventh category of health promotion in general. Then in the second row, we limited our CINAHL search to the five selected journals and recorded the number of articles found on lifestyle behaviors in each journal. As Rachel mentioned before, the journals that were not in CINAHL for all 5 years of the time period were searched by hand. So in total, 931 articles were reviewed by title or abstract or full text as necessary, and 23 of those were found to fit our inclusion criteria. Next, we have the same format for the 2006-2009 flowchart. In this time period, though, all the journals were covered in CINAHL, so none had to be searched by print copies. We reviewed 650 articles turned up by CINAHL and determined that 42 fit our inclusion criteria. For our statistical analysis, due to the small sample sizes of our study, some often under five, we chose the Fisher's exact test to calculate the statistical significance of the change in the number of articles found between the two time periods. We used the computer program SPSS to analyze the change in the volume of articles on all the lifestyle behaviors combined and each lifestyle behavior individually. A p-value of less than 0.05 was deemed to be significant. And these are the results of our study. The lifestyle behaviors written in red were found to have statistically significant changes, and the ones in black were not. So physical activity and exercise showed a big jump from 12 articles in the old time period to 34 articles in the new one, or 1.2% of all articles published up to 3.67. smoking cessation and nutrition optimization had considerably fewer articles in both time periods and did not significantly change over time. Weight control also had relatively few articles and change over time was not significant. Stress management was the only lifestyle behavior to show a decrease from 15 down to 5, which was statistically significant. And sleep hygiene was found to have a significant increase over time, even though it only went from 0 to 3 articles. So, and overall, the aggregate total of articles on all the lifestyle behaviors combined rose from 23 to 42, representing 4.5% of all the articles published in our 5 selected journals in the 2006 to 2009 time period. This was a statistically significant increase with a p-value of 0.007. Here are the same results presented in chart form and broken down by journal. So each lifestyle behavior is listed on the left. Here, once for the old time period, and again below for the recent time period, journals are listed vertically on the top. And the red column on the right shows the p-value of the change in the volume of articles on each lifestyle behavior between the two time periods. As Rachel mentioned before, some articles discuss more than one lifestyle behavior, but are still only counted as one article towards the total, which is why some of the columns here don't appear to add up correctly. In this next chart, we've taken the number of articles in each journal from the last chart and calculated the percentage of articles they represent in each journal. For example, in the old time period, articles on physical activity and exercise made up 1.1% of all the articles written in Physiotherapy Canada. And in the recent time period, physical activity and exercise made up 7.32% of all articles in Physiotherapy Canada. As already mentioned, it was important to calculate percentages to control for a change in the volume of literature over time. So, of the 6 lifestyle behaviors examined, physical activity and exercise returned the most search results and showed the largest increase in proportions between the two time periods. This implies that physical therapists place more attention on the health benefits of exercise than any other lifestyle behavior. This is perhaps not surprising given that exercise is a lifestyle behavior traditionally the most core to the field of physical therapy, and that it's an important component of other healthy lifestyle behaviors as well, particularly weight control, stress management, and sleep hygiene. Despite the known benefits of exercise, 47% of Canadians are considered inactive. We recommend that further investigation be undertaken to determine how best to close the gap between what's known in the literature and the lifestyle behaviors followed by the general public. The number of articles on smoking cessation did not increase over time. In fact, 3 of the 4 smoking cessation articles in the later time period were from a single special edition of Physiotherapy Theory and Practice. These results suggest that the physical therapy community has not and is not placing a great degree of attention on the role it could play in promoting smoking cessation. In our opinion, as a discipline with a significant focus on lung and heart health, physical therapists are capable of speaking authoritatively on the harms of smoking and the benefits of quitting. Furthermore, studies have shown that exercise can be an effective component of smoking cessation programs, and as exercise specialists, physical therapists could play a role. Current research has identified that although physical therapists recognize their clinical responsibility to advise patients regarding smoking cessation, the majority do not feel prepared to deliver smoking cessation counseling and encounter barriers such as lack of resources and time. Further investigation into how to better prepare physical therapists to provide smoking cessation counseling and manage barriers is warranted. And Pfizer will now continue our discussion on nutrition, weight, stress, and sleep.
All right, so with regards to nutrition optimization, the volume of data share on nutrition did not change. It's interesting to note that all of the articles in the early time period were found in a single journal, Physiotherapy, whereas in the later time period, they were divided among 3 journals. This may actually reflect a wider spread of focus on nutrition among physiotherapy community. However, only one of the articles considered nutrition independently of other lifestyle behaviors and gave specific practice guidelines reflecting a possible lack of direct research on the effect of nutrition in physiotherapy. As physiotherapists, we know that we'll be working with overweight people, individuals with abnormal blood sugar, high-performance athletes, people with tissue injuries, all of which would benefit from guidance and referral for proper nutritional management. Therefore, it could be a really useful adjunct to physiotherapy treatment. Therefore, we concluded that further investigation into the potential role of physiotherapy therapists in nutritional guidance would be very beneficial. With regards to weight control, again, results of the study did not show a percentage change in the article on weight control. We know that weight control has been gaining increasing global attention as obesity rates continue to rise. And before, in our early time period, weight control used to be considered only a problem in high-income countries. But World Health Organization now recognizes the percentage of the population which is overweight or obese is also increasing in urban areas of low or middle-income countries. Obesity has been shown to be a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, cardiopulmonary restriction, musculoskeletal impairments, and psychosocial factors. And with regards to health concerns associated with obesity, it's a global issue that impacts all areas of physiotherapy. Since obesity is often a result of reduced activity and exercise in combination with poor nutrition, it may not be considered as a factor, as a separate topic in the physical therapy literature. In fact, in the later time period, out of the five articles we found, only two of them considered weight control as an independent factor. So we think that while physiotherapists are known for their expertise in exercise, they're not principally utilized for their ability to help with weight control. Therefore, further research could determine how physiotherapists could best incorporate effective weight control management interventions into their physiotherapy treatment plans. We got very interesting results on stress management. Out of all six lifestyle behaviors that we considered, stress management was the only one that decreased in number over the two time periods. In 1986 to 1989, this topic accounted for the most articles of any lifestyle behavior, which might reflect the prominence of that issue in the society at the time. However, in the later time period, the attention placed on stress management was roughly equal to all the other lifestyle behaviors, except for physical activity and exercise, which was the most. The World Health Organization has labeled stress as the health epidemic of the 21st century. A study has shown that stress underlies more than 70% of doctor visits, which follows that physiotherapists also see a large proportion of patients experiencing at least some degree of stress. Stress plays a strong role in motivation, performance, perception of pain and disability. Therefore, stress is a very important factor in patients' ability to actually participate in physiotherapy treatments. As physiotherapists, we have the ability to teach a client relaxation techniques, help them build their confidence, educate patients on the effect of stress, and help them improve coping strategies. We have the skill set to incorporate stress reduction as part of our intervention. So further research could identify whether physical therapists are recognizing stress and referring appropriately, what is the impact of stress on physical therapy treatment outcomes, and what role can physiotherapists play in stress management. Sleep hygiene. This is a very new and under-examined topic in physiotherapy literature. There was a statistically significant increase in the volume between the two time periods, but it's important to note that in the earlier time period, there were no papers published on this topic in physiotherapy journals. And later on, in the second time period, there were only three papers published. Out of the three, all of those three papers were published in a 2009 special issue of Physiotherapy Theory and Practice Journal. And only one of them focused on sleep hygiene independently from other lifestyle behaviors and the role that physiotherapists can actually play in it. It's well known that poor sleep hygiene is associated with heart disease, hypertension, mood disorders, immune dysfunction, diabetes, obesity, and we all know that good sleep hygiene augments healing and health. Therefore, we definitely need more research in this area. We need to know what are the effective sleep hygiene management strategies for physios. is it even within our scope of practice? And do we feel clinically competent in the sleep hygiene management? Now I'm going to give it back to Sarah to finish the discussion on laptop.
Thank you, Faiza. So lastly, looking at the total proportion of articles, we did find that they increased over time. So this would indicate that the academic community is paying more attention on lifestyle behaviors and their role in patient health. However, we also noticed that the overall increase was driven by the results of physical activity and exercise, indicating that it, above the others, is where the physical therapy community is directing its focus. While we recognize that that is our area of expertise, we feel that physical therapists are well poised to provide the health behavior education on the other lifestyle behaviors that we examined. And even with a statistically significant increase on the total proportion of articles, this appears to be nothing compared to the prevalence of lifestyle-related conditions as they continue to rise. This finding supports the view that there is a gap between the knowledge that physical therapists receive in the literature and clinical practice. Further research would be necessary to determine exactly where the gap lies on the continuum from academic research to clinically improved health outcomes, and from there, how to best bridge that gap. That leads to the next point, which would be to consider the gap between the lifestyle education that the general public receives and their adherence to lifestyle modification or willingness to change. The quantitative results of this study offer many questions for discussion and ideas for future research, which we've already touched on a lot of those. A few more are, has this change in literature been implemented into clinical practice to help combat the global healthcare crisis? As the incidence of comorbidities continue to rise, what role can our profession play in public health and patient education? And although we've seen a change in the literature, and from this, if the change has gone to clinical practice, have specific patient health outcomes changed? How confident do physical therapists feel about a potential role in providing patient education regarding all, like the full spectrum of the lifestyle behaviors we discussed? These are great questions for future research in the long term. By successfully improving the lifestyles of the general public, we can vastly decrease morbidity and mortality rates, as well as improve individual quality of life and reduce healthcare costs globally. Discussing limitations of our study, the first limitation was that it was a purely quantitative analysis. As such, unfortunately, it did not evaluate the content or quality of the articles, and it did not include editorials or opinion pieces, some of which we determined would have been directly applicable to our studies, but they were not considered peer-reviewed articles and thus did not meet our inclusion criteria. Secondly, the data was extracted from only 5 generalist journals. Thus, it did not include any of the trends towards lifestyle behavior modification in more specialist journals. A third point is to consider that the current list of core physical therapy generalist journals changes over time. A study in November 2010, which was after our study began, identified only physical therapy and the Journal of Physiotherapy, previously known as the Australian Journal of Physiotherapy, as core generalist journals. Also, when it came to lifestyle behavior categorization, this study did not differentiate whether a lifestyle behavior was a primary or a secondary topic of an article, and it did not examine the relative focus of each lifestyle behavior when more than one was discussed, or the importance or impact that any of the articles might have had on the clinical community. Therefore, our results can only provide an estimate of the attention being placed on each lifestyle behavior. Lastly, we recognize that this study measures the responsiveness of the academic physical therapy community, which we feel may or may not correlate with the responsiveness of the clinical physiotherapy community. So to conclude, this study did show a statistically significant increase in the proportion of articles, specifically physical activity and exercise, which had the greatest increase, but also sleep hygiene and all of the lifestyle behaviors combined. This suggests that the physical therapy community has been responsive to the increasing prevalence of these lifestyle-related conditions. However, we did note the decreasing trend towards literature attention on physical therapists and stress management. To determine if these trends are being reflected in the more specialist physical therapy literature, we would recommend that future researchers dive in deeper and adapting and expanding on our methods presented to review all of the physical therapy related literature, the gray literature, and if deemed necessary, the medical literature. With respect to dissemination, we will be applying for publication in Physiotherapy Canada. And we would like to extend some acknowledgments. A thank you to Dr. Elizabeth Dean for her guidance and feedback throughout this entire research project. To Charlotte Beck for her extensive support, education, and guidance while helping us create our search strategy, as well as helping us figure out how to use RefWorks. Dr. Teresa Lee Ambrose was a great help with the stats and with the statistical analysis, and Dr. Darlene Reed gave us some very good initial feedback. And as well, we'd like to thank Jody Wilner for her initial contribution and energy towards this work. Any questions? That is a great question. We were looking at two government reports whenever we were developing this research. The first was the Lalonde Report, which was published in 1974. And it really emphasized the focus. It was a Canadian report emphasizing the focus from medical treatment of illness to prevent, from the medical treatment of illness to the prevention, prevention aspect, and emphasize the role that individuals might have to play in maintaining good health through healthy behaviors. So from that, we wanted to give time for that to kind of trickle down into, well, globally, as well as into the academic community and see what research came out of that. So that's where the 86 to 89 timeframe came from, primarily. And then there was also the Romanov report, which echoed a lot of the same things from the Lalonde report, and it was published in 2006. So that kind of gave us a good basis for the 2006 to 2009 timeframe to look from to help guide some of the stuff we were looking at.
That was
2002, sorry.
Yeah, they really just started to emphasize that we should be switching our focus to preventative health, so things like lifestyle, behavior modification.
We also had to consider a little bit the databases and how, where, when we could get full text articles from, and what was online, and what would be found in the search strategy. And so there was a lot of that initial discussion around what time periods to consider, and the 20-year period seemed to be an acceptable one based on what we could find in CINAHL, what we had in the library, and then and the reports.
Yes. Great job, by the way. I know how nebulous this topic is, so well done. You guys talk about how, I guess your report reflects maybe a cultural shift in attitudes toward prevention versus disease remediation. I was just wondering if you guys had thought about any sort of suggestions on how we can get physiotherapists on board with prevention rather than curing diseases. Whether there was any
We hadn't gone quite that far into exactly what the next step was. We were kind of looking at more if physiotherapists are starting to refocus their attention on prevention, or at least in the literature.
I guess I was wondering, kind of, do you think that this has to be kind of projected by the literature, or whether groups like PABC or something could be spearheading that sort of shift in attitudes?
I think that would be a good role for them, and I think they somewhat fall under the gray literature and sort of the information that they put out there, and maybe physiotherapists would rely more on that, but it's also, we wanted to look at global trends, and so choosing these five journals seemed to be a better way to do that.
Your question brings up a lot of the questions that we did ask when writing our paper and when considering our discussion topics, and as you know, we had a lot of questions that came out of this, like, what would this look like, and what if we just focused on this area, but given the fact that our research was purely quantitative and just really wanted to start to ask those questions and give a baseline for further research as the first kind of extensive analysis of the literature that's been done. So we're really hoping that it does open the floor to clinicians to say, hey, why are we not doing this? What could that look like? Who could help better support us? And PABC would be a great example of that.
I think a lot of it is the fact that we're not recognizing some of the things that we're doing either. For example, looking at a lot of the articles that we found, we only looked at them quantitatively rather than actually reading the papers, but we could find very few papers that focus on one lifestyle behavior independently. So that just gives us the idea that they're all connected. Rate control is connected with physical activity, connected with steps, like nutrition, all of that. So even just this study could give us some guidelines that we can't just focus on one. It needs to be all
I guess, first of all, kudos to you for such an intensive search. I mean, I know what our search process was like, and doing those few time frames, it looked so complex. So good job for being able to do that. I guess my second, more of a comment, I guess, in keeping with what Rochelle was saying, we were going through such an integral shift in towards this behavior, healthy lifestyle change and health prevention education. And I guess in keeping with the trend and what you guys are trying to kind of extract from the literature right now in terms of what we have, I'm further curious as to our training as physiotherapists and whether we actually have adequate training in terms of the counseling aspect, because we are counseling so much in our treatment sessions specifically with this, and whether we actually do have adequate training to be able to be effective.
The study that Pfizer commented on with respect to smoking cessation and counseling, that was a really interesting study that just said that point. Like, physical therapists, it really drove that point home, that physical therapists are well aware of their need. Like, we can help someone who smokes, but really that knowledge, translating it to practice, do they really have the support? Like, what? There's no set up plan for helping a patient who smokes to quit, right? Other than referring to them to their medical doctor. And those of you who might have had experience with the current medical system, it's a little overloaded right now. They might not be able to get that support that they need to follow a plan that will help someone quit such an addiction. So that was really identified, that even though the knowledge was there that we need to help, there was a gap towards guidelines that clinicians can feel competent in that area.
That would be even something interesting to look into for, like, part of our program or as continuing education options. I mean, since we're in such a position to see these people, and things like smoking would really affect their outcomes, whether it's in private practice or it's a cardiorespiratory patient in a hospital setting. I mean, it has such an impact on outcomes that I think it would be a really big benefit to have that sort of education out there for physiotherapists to take advantage of so that they can help their clients better.
Just kind of follow up on that. I mean, we're kind of in a bit of in terms of our scope, almost a supply and demand kind of scenario. I mean, part of this would be what the patient sees our role as. I mean, like, in terms of smoking cessation and whatnot, if you were to come off the street and go to a physiotherapist, would you expect them to tell you how to stop smoking? You know what I mean? Like, what kind of role do you think that whole patient perception is, and how would you change that?
Well, I mean, it's not like you would come to us directly for that, but if you're here for treatment and that could be an adjunct to our therapy, I mean, I think it would be a benefit to us and to them. Yes.
Medical field has become so specialized that we forget to look at the person as a whole. We refer, like, we don't go to a physio for a stress management, we don't go to a psychiatrist. But the psychiatrist doesn't realize that maybe you can't suggest exercise, but doesn't realize maybe you don't have the other to exercise because of other reasons. You know what I mean? Like, we have to start looking at them as a whole, and we do need the training. We did see the lack of literature. Lack of literature means that there won't be the training, basically.
And what do you do when you, one of the things that got brought up in our discussion while we were doing this research was, okay, so nutrition optimization and weight control. You have a patient who's overweight. How confident do we feel in providing guidance for that? Or a patient even says to you, like, I know you need to lose weight, like, any thoughts? Do we say, oh, you know, like, I know this great dietitian, why don't you work with them, when you're already overloaded and stressed about the time that you have to take off work for physio, the fact that you can't hardly walk with no pain, you have another appointment, you're losing money because you're self-employed and you can't, you know, you don't have the money to get better from your physical illness, and now you want me to see a dietitian on top of it and go, hey,
for that support, it's like it kind of became a bit of a snowballing issue of what we feel comfortable doing. And if that's just providing patients with even a guidelines for the pyramid, the food guide, thanks, Canada's food guide, then how beneficial would that be? That it leads to discussion around that as well.
I think you've also got a big issue here with interprofessional care, and I think you're choosing to ignore the interprofessional care, and you know that we don't have the total scope in all of this, and it depends where we're working as well, whether we work interprofessionally or not. And I think that's reflected in your findings, and that as an there's also been a huge change towards interprofessional care between your beginning years and your latter years. And therefore, that also might be reflected in the literature, because I've only published in that second section. I'm a physiotherapist by background, but never published in the physical therapy or any of those journals that you actually have, because I consider myself an interprofessional worker and interprofessional research. How would you take that into consideration?
Well, I think we somewhat identified that as a limitation of our study, the fact that we really did focus on the physiotherapy-specific literature, just at least have a starting point for this. But you're right, I mean, the medical journals have lots of physiotherapy articles in them, and then there's the specialist journals, which may show different trends.
Because I think that's why you've seen this big change in physical activity and exercise and not in smoking, because if I was doing something on smoking, even as a physiotherapist, I would never choose to actually publish in one of those journals. I would be interested why those three articles were published in those journals, because, you know, I think there's a very specific reason that they were published. And I think it was because you said that it was one specific journal. Was that the sleep
one? It was a special edition.
Exactly. So that's why it was there. Nothing to do with the actual change in clinical treatment or whatever. And the only way you can actually look at what's happening in clinical treatment is to look at clinical treatment.
Mm-hmm. That's not what we were looking at. We were looking at the change in education, and we said it, that we're hoping that another study could do that. It would actually also be very interesting if that later on people take a look at each of these lifestyle behaviors individually, and also take a look at other journals as well. One thing to mention is that we don't consider, the point of this wasn't the fact that we consider ourselves a specialist in stress treatment. Obviously, someone who needs to be treated for clinical depression needs to go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. We consider ourselves, the point of this was the fact that we should pay attention what the stress might act, what role might the stress play into our physical therapy treatment, or what role could weight management play in our physical therapy treatment. Obviously, for nutrition, we need to go to
specialist articles aren't meant to tell you that. Specialist articles are on that specific.
Yeah.
I just have a comment kind of related to that last comment. We did a very similar systematic review on a similar topic, and we were looking at literature broadly published everywhere, and we found very few results just in general on everything, even though we're scoping for all interventions done by physiotherapists. But we did come up with some results that wouldn't have been included in their studies, where physios were collaborating with dietitians and physicians to provide interventions on weight loss management. That was kind of the biggest aim, was usually obesity control, and also smoking cessation, I think, came up in one as well. But what I like about their article that picks up that ours would be the discussion in the physiotherapy-related literature about lifestyle-related conditions, because we had to exclude a lot of really relevant articles that recommended physios for this role, that it wasn't showing what they were already doing, but was recommending it to kind of suggest this for future research. So I think that the value of their research in just looking at those articles is that it looks at kind of the attitudes of physiotherapists and what they're considering is important.
It would also be interesting to see the valid point around the trend towards the interprofessional thing, especially, well, in all aspects, between public and private practice. I know even from my discussions with clinicians on our research, I've had some interesting ones over the past month where people have said in private practice, oh, our practice is going that way. You know, our practice is working to become more of a wellness center, or we're opening a wellness center kind of next door. We're going to incorporate this yoga thing into our, as an adjunct to what our practice has to offer, so that if it might benefit a patient, they can come and have that be part of their treatment, which can would impact maybe some of the stress aspect, which might impact the sleep, which would also impact the regular activity and exercise, which could, you know, go down the line to providing more support. It's just big, but anyway.
Did you find in your articles that there were certain areas of physiotherapy that were more focused on lifestyle changes, like cardiovascular physio was more inclined to communicate about smoking cessation, for example?
We didn't really break them down for content or the focus of practice of physiotherapy that the articles were discussing the interventions for. And because we looked at the generalist journals, it wasn't obvious from the journals either. So we kind of looked at more what physiotherapists could do overall for their patients, as opposed to specific types of physios or types of conditions.
We also, I don't know if this helps too with your comment, Belinda, even just looking, doing a kind of broad scope through all of the 65 that got picked up over the two time periods, there was no real trend towards a specific condition of the specific conditions that we did include, including COPD and emphysema, chronic bronchitis. There wasn't a specific trend towards that being really pulled out for the smoking ones. So we found that interesting. You know, there wasn't diabetes for weight control. Diabetes didn't come up an abnormal number of times, and so that, you know, it would have been interesting if it had. They've been okay, we're focusing on this one area that we looked at.
And just further to that, we just published a study that just came out in Physical Therapy last month of a Canadian-wide physical therapy survey on beliefs and practices regarding smoking cessation in the interest of determining whether they could initiate or support, not that they would be the only counselor or survey person involved. And that was very interesting in that we did see, and it's not surprising, but those who are more sensitized to it, who are working with people who have lung or heart disease, did in fact initiate or support smoking cessation more. But overwhelmingly, the clinical community is, I think was mentioning, that we recognize this is really important, and we don't feel that we have the self-efficacy professionally to be able to institute that. So that was kind of interesting. So if any of you are interested, that was in physical therapy just last month, and it was, I think our sample was 730-something. So you might want to look at that. I think the other point that's interesting is sort of when you come to health promotion, that it's not just looking at these behaviors in isolation, because they can improve. I think there's a lot of evidence to support that, for example, smoking or weight loss will improve other types of physical therapy outcomes, and whether it's in the musculoskeletal area, the neuromuscular area, as well as sort of the cardiovascular and pulmonary areas, and as well as medical outcomes. You know, if we can help somebody to lose weight, that will not only improve some of the outcomes that we're interested in, but help perhaps reduce the amount of medication, help reduce the potential for bariatric surgery or other types of surgery that might be related to that condition. So that's the way we've tried to pitch it in various workshops, sort of the health promotion practice, not just making it this is something, one particular specialty or focus to one particular specialty. We focus it across specialties to help and pitch it so that you can help augment your outcomes as a physical therapist, and also to help support medical outcomes and surgical outcomes as well. And that seems to be something that the clinical community is very receptive to. Do you have any, as new emerging physical therapists, do you have ideas? What would be, as you see yourself now practicing, what would be some things that would be of interest to you in terms of developing some expertise in this area?
Yeah. One idea that I really like that I keep hearing is this idea of regular or like annual physiotherapy checkups. So people can come in, you know, before they have an injury, you know, just to get, whether we specify and say it's a, you know, your annual body movement analysis, or whether we want to go deeper into, you know, other lifestyle stuff, like how much are you meeting your physical activity prescriptions or other things like that. But I really like the idea of, you know, like we go to the dentist once a year to get checkups, we go to our MD to get a checkup, we should do the same thing with physios.
I think we'd have to have really good evidence to do that before we instigate. There's already good evidence that going to your doctor once a year is not a worthwhile thing to do. That you could walk out of the door and drop dead. So I think we need extremely good evidence before we start suggesting that.
If you have any, you can let us know. Yeah.
It's just like some information for people. At Congress, Green Con, we talk about an article that was published in the British Journal of Medicine. It's called The Smoke of Diabetes. It's all about how physical activity can combat like smoking, diabetes, and obesity. And it's like, it was talking about how exercise alone is better than, you know, tons of surgeries or pharmaceutical drugs, things like that. So, yeah, so if you guys want to look at that, it's kind of interesting.
Thank you. So if you'd like the access to that information, that would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Be really interesting. Any other comments? You know, I think the other spin-off of this is in terms of, you know, in this day and age of some turfism and territorialization, is that if somebody's, you know, well managed in terms of their obesity and seeing a nutritionist and whatnot, then, you know, I think it's just being sensitized, I think, as it came up, the awareness. It's not that we have to be all things to all people, but I think that that's an important point, just to be able to bridge and to support what other team members might be doing in the region.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.